and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at.
This contract is about transformation, and it will cost money.
Chicago Teachers Union President Stacey Davis Gates talks new union contract negotiations.
Your alderperson works with their 49 colleagues to set policy on big citywide issues.
And what does an alderperson do? WTTW News explains.
I love you.
And Chicago's queer country music is taking over the local music scene this Pride Month. And now to some of today's top stories. A victory today for advocates of early child care and education.
I am truly very proud to usher in the beginning of a new era for early childhood education and care in Illinois as we create the Department of Early Childhood, our first ever unified state agency dedicated to supporting Illinois' youngest children and their parents.
The new department will consolidate early childhood programs currently operated by three different state agencies, placing them all under this new one. The plan will be fully implemented in 2026. 13 families living with HIV will have a new home in the Englewood neighborhood with help from Chicago House and Social Service Agency.
Chicago House extended a lifeline to me and my children. They provided not just an apartment, but comprehensive wraparound services that allowed me to regain my independence and rebuild my life. Standing here today as the Director of Residential Housing, I am living proof. Thank you. I am living proof of the transformative power of safe and supportive housing.
Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton joined the organization to cut the ribbon on Englewood Family Homes in a community that continues to see a disproportionately high rate of new HIV infections. The site will also provide employment as well as access to HIV testing and crucial care and social services. The office space will also host a housing team that manages nearly 500 units of scattered site and residential housing for people struggling with HIV and homelessness. The family of a Chicago woman says she's disappeared from a yoga retreat in the Bahamas. They say 41-year-old Taylor Casey was last seen at the Sivanandra Ashram Yoga Retreat on Paradise Island on June 19th. The Royal Bahamas Police Force issued a missing persons poster 2 days later. Her mother says she believes Casey is in danger because she went to the retreat to fulfill a lifelong dream of deepening her practice and then sharing it with others upon her return. Her mother, Colette Seymour, and others are heading to the Bahamas to coordinate with local authorities. Up next, one-on-one with the president of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The current contract for Chicago Public School teachers expires in just 5 days. The Chicago Teachers Union wants raises in the new contract, along with advances on other issues, from homelessness to climate change. But those demands are being made as the district faces a nearly $400 million deficit for the coming year, and apparently little appetite in Springfield to find more money for Chicago schools. Joining us now to tell us more about the status of negotiations is Stacey Davis Gates, of course, president of the Chicago Teachers Union. Welcome back, Stacey.
Thank you for having me.
So, current teachers' contract, as we said, it expires in just a few days. Typically, you all are probably a bit farther along in the process by now before we get to that expiration date. But how would you say things are going so far, and what can we expect this time around? Because we all recall what happened last contract negotiation.
Right. So, what I would say is that we would be further along and trying to move the district to a place of negotiation. We do believe we are in a negotiation phase right now, and it is still a little difficult. The cadence, the voice that you don't hear from the CTU is one that is confrontational, because we don't have a mayor being confrontational with us. In fact, we have the opposite. We have a mayor who's encouraged both sides to work together to foment this transformation he is leading in our city.
A couple of weeks ago, CPS and CTU, you all held the first ever public bargaining session. Why did you all feel it was important to have these done publicly?
Look, we've wanted to do this since 2012. This has been a battle cry of our union since Karen Lewis was the president of our union. Then again, when Jesse Sharkey led us. What's changed is that we have a mayor who's willing to put negotiations on the front street, the main street, the front yard of our city. What that means is that Chicagoans get an opportunity to engage with the actual collective bargaining process. And what you see in here, in that actual open bargaining, is what it feels like in negotiations always.
Focus of the most recent session was on creating green and healthy schools. A lot of folks can probably get behind that. But what can we expect to see when public bargaining, and we know it can happen, when it gets down to those little details that it is very hard for the two sides to meet in the middle on?
Well, look, I believe one in four Chicagoans are school-aged. And because I believe one in four Chicagoans are school-aged, what we have to do with this contract is show transformation. We have to set a benchmark that every Chicago public schools can have art, music, physical education, a librarian at every school, sports that encompass all seasons in the school year. These are things that we're working for. These are things that we think families can get behind, and these are things that we certainly think our young people can get behind.
It's been reported that CTU is asking for a 9% pay increase this time around. And in an interview here on Chicago Tonight last week, CPS Chief Pedro Martinez noted that he's proud of the current pay scale for CPS teachers. Here's a little bit of what he said.
We have one of the highest pay schedules for teachers in the country. We have one of the highest starting salaries. Our average teacher salary is over $100,000. I want to make sure we continue to invest in our staff and teachers. I've seen, you know, the benefits of, you know, we have less teacher turnover. We don't have the shortages that other districts have.
Now, Martinez also says that he prioritizes protecting supports for teachers as well as students, as well as protecting enrichment programming. Reaction? Thoughts?
Well, if he was interested in protecting supports, then our teachers' assistants would be made whole. Right now, we are in a bit of a tension-filled negotiation with the district over the 300 teacher assistants that were laid off. That's problematic because that is support personified in our school communities. And, you know, here's this thing about feeling good about having a lower teacher shortage. It still is a teacher shortage. And so doing something about that shortage means that he's going to actively recruit Black teachers with us. We go to HBCUs and make sure that we're bringing some of the best and the brightest talent back to Chicago so Black children can see Black teachers. He would also work with us in securing programming that helps to support our newish teachers in the classroom. So he can not only say that on Chicago Tonight, he can actually agree to those things because they're actual proposals in our contract.
So let's get into that a little bit more, because you've written that Pedro Martinez is, quote, resorting to business as usual. In what way?
Well, in the layoffs. How can you say in one interview that support for our teachers is important? Well, having a teacher's assistant is important, especially when you have oversized classrooms, especially when you work in communities that need more and have been historically disadvantaged. Look, our union is 80% female. Our teacher's assistants are over 80% Black and brown. And many of our school communities, it is our teacher's assistants who are welcoming our newcomers who speak a completely different language. We need them as anchors into our school communities, and that means that they are supported. And that means that he should make sure that they're there this upcoming school year.
Are those people who are laid off, the TAs and or teachers, are they not able to be rehired at some of the district hiring fairs and positioned at different schools or hired at different schools?
Well, that's the thing about transformation, and that's the thing about the moment we're in right now, Brandis, is that business as usual is to disrupt the school community, send people in different places and hope that they resettle sometime in September. What we want is stability from year to year to year. We want to build a legacy of success and stability. Take out the variability that you have in communities south of Roosevelt. Make sure that we are enriching all of our school communities in ways in which there's stability, there's a benchmark of what all families can expect to have at any Chicago public school.
So what I'm trying to reckon with is if the mayor, the new administration, is known to be an ally of CTU based on his experience. Obviously, he has a responsibility to the city, but he's been a friend to CTU. And if he is maintaining CPS CEO Pedro Martinez in his position, why shouldn't we be seeing a more amicable relationship, or why aren't we seeing a more amicable relationship between Pedro Martinez and CTU?
Well, look, I don't know how you define amicable. What I'm saying is that this district is going to be challenged to do differently than they have in the past. That means that they're going to actually have to sit at a table with women who are doing the work in that building and actually shift priorities. They're going to have to think about new modalities and new methodologies and ways in which to staff the school community, but even more so, ways in which to enrich the school community with librarians, with social workers, with counselors, with clinicians that we don't have there currently. We need a baseline, and you can go to different communities and different zip codes and get something very different. We have to establish a benchmark, and that's what the tension is expressing right now, is that our district is very comfortable with what they have done already. What we're saying is that Chicago chose someone new. They didn't choose Paul Vallis. They chose a middle school teacher, and that middle school teacher believes in smaller class sizes. And because Chicago chose that, then they're going to choose something that looks more like the proposals that we are putting forward.
You've joked that the contract is going to cost $50 billion mm-hmm. and 3 cents. You and your members, of course, have lobbied Springfield lawmakers to fully fund Chicago public schools. We know that they've created a ramp for the evidence-based funding formula, and we're not there yet. We're not at the top of that ramp yet. But it sounds like there's probably not that much support right now in Springfield for giving Chicago public schools more money. How do you all respond to the state and state lawmakers if that is the case, that they choose not to give more money to Chicago public schools?
Well, we don't think that the Illinois General Assembly should only be giving money to the Chicago public schools. Listen, this budget crunch that school districts are going to feel across the state is not going to just be in Chicago. So what our state legislators and our governor have to come to terms with is this idea of figuring out how to make all ends meet at the same time fomenting transformation in the largest school district and the largest city and the economic engine of the state of Illinois. They have a duty to make sure that our schools are fully funded and that our students are getting exactly what they deserve.
Almost out of time, but I want to ask, of course, Chicago's first ever school board elections happening in November. 47 candidates vying for 10 seats. How is CTU supporting these elections? Are you providing money to any candidates, foot soldiers? Or are you supporting any individual candidates out loud?
Well, you know, our process is well known throughout Chicago, and our members are in the middle of that process right now. So those details are forthcoming, but I can tell you what our members are. They are very excited at the opportunity to vote for their neighbors. They're very excited to work with the people who are in the same communities as they reside, and to knock on doors and to talk to people about what our students deserve. They deserve a fully funded education. They deserve joy in their school day. They deserve school communities that are safe and protective to everyone. And so we're very excited about the democracy that Chicago is going to experience in November.
All right. We look forward to having you back again to talk about this contract as it comes together, Stacey, and of course later on when that board is implemented. Stacey Davis-Gates, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yesterday, former Chicago Alderman Ed Burke was sentenced to 2 years in prison and fined $2 million after being convicted on corruption charges. He joins dozens of previous Alder people who've also ended up in prison. Certainly not all Alder people are crooks, but just what does an Alder person do? Heather Sharone tells us in the latest edition of WTTW News Explains.
Every 4 years, residents of Chicago's 50 wards pick their representatives on the City Council, officially known as Alderpeople. They earn between $115,000 and $150,000 a year. Not too shabby for a job that comes with instant fame and allows for nearly unlimited side hustles. But what exactly does an Alderperson do? Their official job can be divided into two big buckets: citywide duties and ward services. Your Alderperson works with their 49 colleagues to set policy on big citywide issues like public safety, housing, and transportation. They also decide whether to raise or lower taxes and how to spend those bucks by passing a budget, which they negotiate with the mayor, who isn't a member of the City Council but presides over its meetings. The mayor gets to pick who serves as chairs of the city council's nearly two dozen committees. Those alder people have some real power and get to decide which ordinances and resolutions get a piece of the city hall spotlight and stand a chance of becoming law. Life outside City Hall can be much less glamorous. Alder people are in charge of providing direct city services to the nearly 50,000 people in their ward. That's about the population of a well-sized suburb. And unfortunately for them, those 50,000 Chicagoans want that pothole filled now, and a new garbage cart now. And they want that tree in the parkway trimmed, you guessed it, now. But in return for dealing with the nitty-gritty details of city government, alder people are free to function like mini mayors of their small part of the city under a decades-old tradition known as aldermanic prerogative. Fueled by the deference of the other members of the city council, each alder person gets to decide much of what should and should not happen in their ward. That means if, for example, you want to open a unique, super niche specialty cafe, you best get the local alder person on board before you slap the first coat of paint on the walls. While many alder people are dedicated public servants, more than a few have let that nearly unchecked power go to their heads and ended up becoming the mini-mayor of a much smaller piece of real estate, a prison cell. And if you think it's hard to get that pothole filled with your alder person busy serving the community, you'll find that it's a lot harder when they're serving time.
You can catch more of our Emmy Award-winning digital series, WTTW News Explains, on our website. There is a queer country music movement that is getting louder, with Chicago leading the band. The cowboy boot-wearing, southern drawl-having, lasso-swinging genre has big roots in the Windy City, and this Pride Month is proving it also has a deep connection with the LGBTQ+ community. Joining us now are Alexis Stein, an organizer at Queer Social Club, Rochelle Gordon, journalism professor at Northwestern and member of hashtag Queer Country Bandwagon, Iris Marlowe, a local alt-country music artist, and Andrew Saw, a Chicago-based singer-songwriter and country crooner. Welcome, everybody. I am excited about this segment, as you can tell. Alexis, let's start with you, please. So you're the founder of Queer Social Club. You help organize Swappin' Boots. Yes. It is a popular two-step night for Chicago's LGBTQ+ community. What is it, and how did it start?
So Swappin' Boots, it's pretty much the same every time people come. They have a little hour-long lesson, a two-step lesson with Billingsley and Earp, who are amazing musicians themselves. And then we get the band going, and there's covers of country songs, and then, yeah, people start dancing. Actually, Andrew and Rochelle have both been performers. It got started when Local Universe and I decided that we wanted to collaborate, and we had a conversation. Two-step came up as an event possibility, and I was like, hell yeah, let's do it.
Let's do it. And so you mentioned, Rochelle, your band, Queer Country Bandwagon. It has played at Swappin' Boots. Why do you think an event like this is so popular in a city like Chicago?
Well, one thing that I have discovered is that there are a lot of queer folks in Chicago who grew up in a place where country music was all around them, and they don't necessarily mind the sound of it, maybe like the sound of it, they just don't like the slice that gets played on country radio. I've been talking about this band, starting this band for about a year to other LGBTQ people, and it is amazing how many times when I said I was working on that project, the response was, F yeah, not just yeah. And I think, you know, this is a great city, a tolerant city, inclusive city to live in, and this is a really fun event where you can hang with other people that you feel comfortable with. And I can tell you, as someone who's played on stage and looked down, it is so delightful to see all these, every flavor of human being you can imagine dancing with every other flavor of human being on the dance floor. It's so much fun.
It's a moment. Andrew's like, say more. So you've toured across the country in many queer country spaces. What have you learned about the draw that queer folks have to country music?
The draw? The one thing that I would remark on is that I've been surprised everywhere I've gone there is a draw, and a large draw. Sold out shows wherever I've been, and it isn't sold out because my name's on the bill. It's sold out because Queer Country is on the bill. I have a couple of ideas as to why, and Rochelle kind of spoke on it. I think that, you know, gender roles are such a big part of country music and its history that queer people, we like to mess with that. And it may be one of the final...
Disrupting
those roles. Yeah. It might be one of the final frontiers to do so in the music world.
So country music, it doesn't always have the best reputation, as Rochelle said, when it comes to diversity and inclusion, at least in the mainstream. It's typically dominated by cisgender, heterosexual white men. Last year, we saw how Jason Aldean's Try That in a Small Town caused a bunch of controversy. Yep, turned up your nose to that one. because yes. Some people called it out for its, you know, as nationalist rhetoric. Iris, you know, how do you reconcile your love for a genre that hasn't always been accepting of your identity?
That's a great question. So I grew up in a small town, less than 1,000 people, and growing up, there was a lot of misunderstandings of different walks of life because there was no representation. So it means so much to me to be a part of something that has twisted that narrative, because there is a lot of negative stereotypes of country music if you're looking for it, but there's a huge variety of people that are bringing new narratives to the front and bring new sounds and making a space available for people who didn't feel like they belonged before. So yeah, it is really special to be from a small town that has that message into a big city where that's not really, people don't like that message at all. And we can make new ones and make people feel welcomed.
Can I talk about I discovered that this space even exists? Because I became a fan of Andrew's several years ago. I noticed that there was this thing called the Cosmic Country Show, and I came quickly to realize that cosmic equals queer. And initially I thought that, you know, queer country music was just an Andrew thing. And then I discovered there's this huge community that revolves around Andrew that also is in this space. And I thought, oh, it's just a Chicago thing. Nope. And then I discovered, no, actually, you know, I mean, literally, I searched for hashtag queer country on Instagram and found this amazing deep dive of stuff. And there are so many artists in this space that are making great music who are gender or sexuality nonconforming. And they're making great music, not usually dealing with the same subject matter that country radio deals with.
Well, and I want to hear some of that music because, Andrew, we know you're a crooner. Throwback to some of the earlier classic country sounds like Patsy Cline, Loretta Lynn. So here is a clip of you covering Linda Ronstadt's Blue Bayou. We talked about sort of disrupting the genre. How would you say your artistry does that? Subverts the norms?
What queer art doesn't subvert the norms?
Well, there it is.
I would say how I try is to... I encourage people to cry.
Well, and doesn't country music do that a little bit?
Absolutely. But I especially focus on men.
Try in a queer
way. That's what
you're into. You're right. I hope that answers your question.
I think it does. Iris, similar question to you. How do you, and because we're almost out of time and I want to get two more in, but how do you hope to contribute to sort of this cultural shift that we're seeing with other, you know, with other artists as well, like Brandi Carlile and others?
So I like to mix my love of horror films and kind of like scary movies and things like that, which queer people love. Horror and scary movies, and I want to intertwine that with part of my history and my past, and that's country music, so that's also queerness as well. So that's mixing all that together in my own kind of version of what country music is to me.
It's all happening. It's all happening right here. Alexis, I'm going to let you get us out of here. We've got a few seconds left, but you created Queer Social Club because you saw a need for a queer community in Chicago following the pandemic. What's next?
Well, there are bigger and better things on the horizon. Andrew and I are working on something very exciting together this fall, a queer Americana festival, so stay tuned for that.
Okay. Looking forward to it. All right, that is where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to all of you, Alexis Stein, Iris Marlowe, Rochelle Gordon, and Andrew Saw. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you
so much.
Of course.
And that is our show for this Tuesday night. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news. You can also get the show via podcast and the PBS video app. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10 for Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Plans to expand mental health care services across the city. And one man's mission to get everyone running with his Slow AF Run Club. I know. No, it's real. It's real. I'm a member. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, which is proud to honor founder and senior partner Robert Clifford, who has been named in Forbes 2024 list of America's top 200 lawyers.